imagine her in ways that we cannot see. The book is the only book in the Bible, I believe, that does not mention God. There's not a prayer offered in the book, and yet the hand of God is throughout the story. We are looking at a compilation of scriptures in chapter 1 and chapter 2. And Rachel, if you would mind, come read those for us. I should say as she's coming that the narrative that really does affect the story from beginning to end is that there's a man named Haman, and he is out to destroy the Jewish people. He has a plot to destroy the Jews, and really the book is about how God brings about their salvation. And so we don't find out about Naaman until a few chapters later, but the salvation is beginning even in chapter 1 before we're aware of the subplot.
Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagatha, Zethar, and Carcass, seven eunuchs who served
Hold up one second. Somebody named their kid Bigthar. Did you just catch that? Go ahead. Hadn't caught that the first time I read it. Go ahead.
Seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people, the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This thing pleased the king, and he did so. In Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured when Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised, and Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus in his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. The king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king.
So you heard the story, right? And if I can summarize, and then I really just want to make one statement and try to drive it home today. Here's the king, and he's, you know, your kind of guy, right? He's having this feast. He's having this drunken feast. It's a six-month party for several hundred of his closest friends. So here he is feasting, and at some point in the feast, he's bragging about how beautiful his queen is. Talking about how wonderful she is. And I guess some of the guys say, well, why don't you show her off? Why don't you bring her down? Bring her here. If she's the most beautiful woman in the world, why don't you prove it? And so he sends some of his servants up to her apartment and tells her to come on down, and he'd like to show her off. And strangely enough, she refuses. I mean, what kind of woman would not want to put on a nice dress and come and be paraded in front of a bunch of drunk men? But somehow she refuses, and the king gets mad. But as I read it, and there's a lot that we didn't read there, I think he's not as angry as maybe he would have been until his advisors come to him. And what his advisors say is, this is really bad, because all us men, we have wives, and if the queen gets away with being disobedient to the king, that's not good for any of us, because our wives are going to say, well, hey, if the queen can say no to the king, I can say no to you. And so they say she's got to be punished. I mean, for the sake of manhood everywhere in the kingdom, she's got to get punished. You can't allow her to do that to you. And so she's rejected as queen. Now, the king's, you know, wonderful guy. He's a guy that many of you would like. He's looking for a new wife. And how does he pursue this new venture in his life? Does he try to meet some different females and try to find a woman who sort of has the same value system as he does? That would be a nice way to have gone about it. Some form of Christian connection, single mingle, something, you know, take a test and let's see if we can find someone who's sort of like me and that we have the same value system. He could have done that, but he's the king. He's smarter than that. There's a better way to do it. You say, well, he could have married a very smart woman, a woman who could really help him rule, someone who could serve as a very good advisor, someone who could help him in the way of administration. But he's smarter than that. That's not what you're looking for in a queen. He says, here's how we're going to find the queen. We're just going to have a beauty contest, and I'm going to try to marry the prettiest woman in the country. That's what I'm looking for. So he has this contest. Now, as I understand the context, there's a lot of girls that they find. They narrow it down, and all of them, I think, are technically going to be either a wife or a concubine of the king. So there's one of four ways that this can go, as I understand it. You got these girls, 12, 18, I don't know, I would think probably at least a dozen. And all of them are going to spend one night with the king. And then out of that one night, he's going to start to put them in one of four places. They spend the night with him, and he doesn't like them. They end up going to a convent, sort of. They're technically his wife. They've had relations, but basically he never wants to see them again, and they can't be married off to someone else because they've been, well, you know, and the king. So they end up in a convent where they're going to live out their days. He's going to care for them. They're going to be his concubines, but they're going to be far off. If he ever wants to go see them again, he knows where to find them, but he doesn't plan on seeing them again. But they go out there, and basically they're going to live their whole lives as widows. No chance of childhood, no chance of bearing children, pardon me. That's where they're going. Or he might like them, but not like them that much, but he likes them enough that he might want to see them again sometime. So they're in the nearer harem. They're in the harem, and they're there in case he would like to, well, you know. So that's part of it. But there's also a chance that he would like them, but not like them enough to make them the queen. And they could end up being one of his half a dozen wives. If they were his wife, they would be in the palace. They would be near to him. They would be closer or dearer to him. Their children, as if they would have children, they have a much better chance that they would have children in that situation. And their children, being a wife of the king, would be princes and or prince. And so their children would have significant privileges. Or they could be the one and they could be the queen, which is what I guess all the girls wanted. I mean, they would be the Melania of the Persian Empire. That would be great, wouldn't it, Jessica? Would you like? No, sorry, that wasn't nice. Be the Melania. And anybody else want to be Melania? Nobody wants to be. I never met a woman who wants to be Melania. I don't understand that, but in any case. But that's what these girls are competing for. And so, as it turns out, Esther finds favor. There's something about Esther that the king likes. Her beauty is what he would like. Maybe the blessing of God is upon her. But she becomes the queen of the most powerful kingdom in the world. She becomes the queen. And so there you have it. And this is the beginning of God working out his plan to save the Jewish people in the Persian Empire. Now I just want to make a statement, and this is as far as I'm going to go today. You know it. If you're a Christian, it's in there. But I want to try to get it from the back burner of your mind to the front of your mind. If I can accomplish that today, that's all that I think that if the Lord would let that happen, that's what I want. Here's the thing. God's ways, God's plan is hard to understand for anybody because it is bigger, vaster, grander than anything that you and I would imagine in and of ourselves. It's going to be hard for you and I to ever comprehend God's plan because it's bigger, vaster, more glorious than anything that we could ever comprehend. I mean, think about this plan. This is the beginning of the plan to save the children of Israel. And how does it begin? The king gets gassed. The king gets drunk with his friends. But nobody's sitting there saying, wow, look at him drink. I mean, he's fallen in the floor drunk. Boy, it's really nice to see a plan of God come together, isn't it? Look at how the plan of God is coming together as this guy drinks himself silly. Nobody's saying that because nobody's seeing it. When they send for Vashti and she refuses, nobody's saying, wow, there's a second step of God's plan. Isn't it wonderful to see God's plan come together? No, it just looks like a marital problem. When he divorces Vashti and then he's looking for a wife, nobody's saying, boy, now something's coming together. This is, I can see it. This is coming together. This is fantastic. Nobody would have looked at Esther being born absolutely beautiful as having anything to do with the salvation of the Jewish people. Nobody saw her as a kid or as a teenager saying, wow, you know, she's a real looker. God could really save the entire Jewish people with her profile. Nobody's saying anything of that nature. Nobody's seeing it all come together. This is the plan of God coming together to save his people. But listen, there's not a prophet. There's not fire from heaven. There's not waters being parted. There's not pillars of fire. There aren't plagues being made. There's none of this stuff. There's no miraculous, no miracles, no healing. There's nothing of that nature. But the plan of God is coming together to save an entire nation. He took the children of Israel and through miraculous ways brought them and saved them from Egypt. But here he's going to save the entire nation of Israel again. And he's going to do it through very human means, nothing miraculous really about it other than that he's moving things around. He's making things happen. He's letting the king get drunk. The queen rejects him. She's a beautiful face. He's got her in the right place. She's going to be able to influence him. Oop, I almost fell off the platform right there. She's going to be able to influence him. And so this is coming together. But again, they don't see that. And that's the way God's plan often is in my life and in your life. His plan is too big, and for that reason, it's going to be very hard for you and I to ever really comprehend what God is doing. Listen to me. You're the puzzle piece. You're the puzzle piece. Have you done a puzzle and it's like a thousand pieces? Now, let's just personify the piece of the puzzle. Thomas personified the third verse a few weeks ago on Sunday night. That was great because nobody ever sings the third verse. And he had this great spiel about how, you know, if you were the third verse, how left out would you feel because nobody ever wants to sing you? Okay, let's just personify the puzzle piece. If you're the puzzle piece and you got a little bit of brown and green on you, you can't see the box. You don't know where you fit in. You're one of a thousand. And if you're at the base of the puzzle and you're getting put in, you don't know what the puzzle looks like. I mean, you can discern where you go and you can discern your little part, but you have no idea what the big picture looks like. And because God is working in a vast way, there's not a single person in this story who can discern what God is doing. Nobody sees it. Nobody can really discern how this is going to work out. It's not till later when Mordecai sort of gets a glimpse of maybe Esther's there for a specific reason. But that comes later in the story. And that's my place and that's your place. Even the people who walk close to God could not discern what He had in mind for their lives. They could not discern it. Remember Habakkuk? Of course you don't. It's a little book in the Old Testament. But Habakkuk is grieving because the country is an absolute disaster. Hezekiah the king has died. It is an absolute disaster in Jerusalem, in the nation. The Babylonians are starting to conquer. They're starting to move that direction. The Babylonians are going to ultimately invade Israel. But he's praying to God and saying, what are you going to do? How is this going to work out? And God says to him, and this is in Habakkuk chapter 1 and 2, He says, I've got a great plan, and if I told you my plan, you would not believe it. It's that great. Habakkuk is very, very happy that God's got a plan, and he's thinking, oh, God's going to save the people. God's going to deliver the nation. This is great. God has a plan. This is wonderful. Who is he going to raise up to deliver this nation? Is he going to raise up a king? Is he going to raise up a prophet? How is God going to do this? He says he's got a great plan. Until God begins to tell him his great plan. And this is God's plan. Israel's going to be defeated. Most of Israel, you're going to be taken into captivity in Babylon, and you're going to be there for 70 years in Babylon. But as it worked out, many of the people taken into Babylon, which was the greatest empire of the day, be later defeated by the Persians, and there's an overlap there. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, they're part of those. They go in, and instead of this little spot, this little nation Israel being in the middle of really nowhere at that time, desolate, he takes the best leadership in Israel and he takes that leadership and he just puts it in the palace of the greatest empire of the day and lets that leadership influence that empire. Remember, one of the guys was Nebuchadnezzar, who was the emperor. And remember at the end where he's praying that he now knows that the God that Daniel serves is the only God, and comes out of that, and out of that comes the decree that everybody will worship the God of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But that's God's plan. It's like, I'm not going to even worry right now about Jerusalem. I'm just going to send the best and brightest to Babylon. Let them take the palace and let them turn Babylon into a place that is much more receptive to the message of the one true God. That's my plan. But then, if you look 580 years into the future, after the 70 years is finished, they don't go home for the most part. The vast, vast majority, and I read somewhere it was like 70, 80% of the people who went into captivity in Babylon, It wasn't nearly as bad as they thought, and they never went home. They stayed in the Babylonian Empire, and it was called Dispersia. And so community spread all over the world of Jewish individuals who were taken from captivity. They were taken to the Babylonian Empire. When they were able to go home, they didn't. So they spread out through the world, called it Dysphoria again. And how did the gospel spread so quickly? What was Paul doing on his missionary journeys? How did the gospel catch fire so quickly? Those little communities, the disciples, Paul specifically, would go to those little communities that formed out of that captivity. They never went home, and that's where the gospel began to spread because they were Jewish, and it was easy to talk to them about the Messiah, and fires began to spread because of what God had done 580 years before. That was God's plan. Habakkuk couldn't imagine that. I mean, all he could see is that God's got to save this nation. He never could conceive that God was going to take, and he said, no, I'm going to take this nation, and this nation is going to infiltrate Babylon from the palace down, and we're going to create the framework so when I send my Messiah, the message can spread like fire through the world. That's my plan. It's bigger than anybody could have imagined. But he could have figured that out. Habakkuk is a puzzle piece. He can't see it. Think about Ruth. You know, Ruth never really, I think, knew what God had in store for her. I think Ruth died without getting it. Because here's Ruth. She's in Moab. Husband dies. She's with Naomi. She's a widow. They come back. And I think that Ruth is just about taking care of Naomi. She's going to care for her former mother-in-law, so she goes and she starts working in the field of a guy named Boaz, and Boaz ends up liking her, and they end up getting married, and they live a very, very happy life, and because of that marriage, Ruth is able to have some kids, and she's able to secure the future of Naomi, and she just becomes this mother. She's found the man that's of her dreams. It was a very nice life that she lived. I don't think she ever imagined that she was actually destined to come back there and to begin to build this wholesome family by which she would be the great-grandmother of King David, and she would be in the lineage, she would be a great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother of Jesus Christ. That's what God had in store for her. I don't think she ever knew it when she was living. I think she knows it now. But she did what God had called her to do. Think about a town. This is one last one. Think about Dothan. Dothan is only in the Bible twice. It's a place. The second time that it's mentioned, something really big and miraculous happened there, and everybody thought that, you know, it was this ultimate display of God's power that everybody looked at and said, wow, God was in that. Dothan was the place that Elijah went up into the heavens in the chariot. And everybody there said, wow, look at what God did. That's amazing, wonderful. But the first time that Dothan is mentioned, something more amazing happened that was had farther implications and was part of a great, larger plan, ultimately the salvation of an entire family and an entire people. Here's what happened the first time in Dothan. A guy named Joseph got thrown into a pit. And it was in Dothan that a caravan came by and his brothers sold him into slavery and he ended up going down to Egypt. It was in Dothan that the pit was that he was thrown into and ultimately sold. Now, nobody thought God was doing anything the first time. Everybody could see God was doing something the second time when the chariot goes up in the sky. Oh, that's God. But nobody was standing there saying, oh, look at God's plan. He's taking Joseph. He's got him in the pit, but he's going to send him down to Egypt, and he's going to become the prime minister. And when he's the prime minister, it's God speaking through him that alerts him of the famine. So it's through the empowerment of Joseph that the Egyptian country is saved from famine. It's also going to be through Joseph that his brothers and his whole family are saved. It's a bigger plan. It involves far more people what happened the first time, but nobody would have owned that as God's handiwork. His plan's just too big. it's too big. And the implications are, and I want you to understand this, one of the implications is you have to be humble. You have to maintain humility. You do not know what God is doing. You say, I know what God's doing in my life. You don't have a clue what God has in store. You can only see a part of it. You usually know your giftings, and sometimes you get the tip of the iceberg in regards to your calling, but I assure you, that's all you're going to know. That's all you're going to know. Now, my dad, every now and then when, you know, I don't have the greatest day, you know, I'll talk to my dad, and dad has told me, and I never corrected him, I never argued, because that wouldn't be very honoring, but I did the last time he did. I just had to have a theological discussion with him, an argument, really. But if I'm having a down day, dad will say, hey, you got to remember your calling. Got to remember God has a call on your life. And the doors you've gone through are doors that he opened. God has a call on your life, and you got to remind yourself that you have a calling. And last time Dad said that, I said, see, that's no comfort at all, Dad. That is absolutely no comfort at all. And I said it nicely. I said it nicer than I do now. Because here's the problem. There's lots of different callings. I mean, you look at the Old Testament, and everybody wants to have the Joshua calling, right? Joshua was a guy who rose up, and he got to take the nation into the promised land. And anybody who is in any form of leadership wants the Joshua calling. It's like, the Lord has called me to this place so that I can take new ground. I'm going to be the conqueror. That's only one calling. There's also the Isaiah calling. And Isaiah's calling was, you know what? You need to go preach, but ain't nobody going to listen to you. That's your calling. Isaiah, you go preach, and ain't nobody going to listen to you, but you preach, and then I can come in, and I can judge the people righteously because you told them, and they didn't listen. That's why Jonah was so angry, right? So Jonah thought that he had the Isaiah call. I want to go preach to the Ninevites. I want them to reject me, and then I want God to destroy them. And those knuckleheads repented, but he wanted the Isaiah call. That's what he wanted. He didn't get the Isaiah call. He got the Joshua call. There's also the Moses call. Remember Moses? You got to think, when Moses brings the children out of Egypt, he thinks he's going to be Joshua and take them all the way to the promised land. Moses did not want to accept the fact that his call was to spend 40 years in the wilderness preparing the people to go to the next step. But that was God's call for him. You get them out, and for 40 years, got to write the laws, you got to get them ready, but mainly your job is to babysit them in the wilderness till I raise up somebody who can take them on to the promised land. See, you may have a hint of your calling, but you don't know the full purpose that God has for you. And it's easy to say, well, I'm called, that means I'm going to be successful. No, sometimes God calls you to play your part, and you're there, and you're transitioning. God calls you to go in and to say things that are unpleasant and get yourself stoned. Or God may call you to go in and take a people to the next level. But you know what? In general, you have no way of knowing your calling till it's all said and done. Because you go in and you think you're Joshua, and it's like, oh, I was Moses. Or you go in and think you're Moses, it's like, oh, I was Isaiah. Or if you're Jonah, you go in and say, oh, God's called me to be Isaiah, and it's, oh, I'm Joshua. Blast. I don't want to be Joshua. See, God's plan is bigger than that. And you don't know what God is doing in your life, so you have to be humble. Again, you may know your gifting, you may know the tip of your calling, but I assure you, you don't know God's full intent for your life, and you are probably going to be like Ruth. You probably aren't going to know on this side of eternity. It's too big for you. It's too big for me. It's too complicated. Habakkuk did not think what was going on now was really to get set up something that would happen 580 years later. If God were to come to you and say, you know what I'm doing in your life, I'm setting up a situation where you're going to end up influencing some people, and then the people that you influence, it's really not going to come to fruition, but it's all going to come to fruition in 500 years. I can't even comprehend that. So my life is to set up a scenario where 500 years from now, something wonderful happens. I mean, who would even want that kind of calling? But it happens. I remember reading about a woman who felt so called to be a missionary to China. I mean, that was her calling. That was her life's ambition. When she would talk to people, she would say, God has called me to be a missionary to China. That's what he's put on my life. And her sister died. There was an incident where her sister and the husband had already died or had left, and she left three children. She had to step in and raise the kids, and she thought that God's will for her life had been detoured because God had called her to China, but now she has to step in, and she will spend her life raising these three children. There's so much despair. Of course, in the end, you know what happened, right? All three children became missionaries to China. And she misinterpreted. She had a heart. She had a craving for the people of China. And she thought that that meant that she would be a missionary to China. What it meant was that she would take her passion and she would put it in three different people. And far more would be done in those three than she would have done herself. You can't see it. It's too big. It's too big. You have to have humility. You have to have humility. You can say, I'm gifted in a way. You can say, I believe I'm called to be here. I'm called to teach this. I'm called to do ministry now here. I'm called to be here. I'm called to connect with these people now. But why, really? You may never know. You may never know. That's why you have to, again, have humility. But having said that, and I'm concluding here, by the way. Having said that, know that there's always two things going on. The one that is that you can't see, which is your piece in the puzzle that God is working out to ultimately redeem the world. You're not going to be able to really comprehend that to any great degree. You're going to get glimpses, but you're not going to know it 100%. But understand that everything that's happening is also serving a more personal goal, which is our complete godliness, which is our complete godliness. Wherever you are, you may not know why you're there or how what you're doing is going to fit into God's plan to redeem the world. But you do know that whatever you face while you're there, the secondary thing is that it's there to make you more godly. There to make you more godly. I mean, marriage. What did Paul say in Ephesians 5? What's the main purpose of marriage? To sanctify you. Now your marriage may do a lot of different things for God, and you're married and you're both working for God, and it's working out a plan, and you're part of that plan. You're part of God's plan to redeem the world. But you may not know, but you can know this, that marriage that you're in is meant to sanctify you. It's meant to be a sanctifying relationship. Everything that you're doing in life is meant to form you closer to the image of Christ. It is. So that's the personal thing that you can know. But again, where you fit into the picture, you cannot know. But have hope. If you're serving God, you're in the picture. You're in the picture. You may not see the picture till you get to heaven, and you may not know how big or how small your role was. But if you're serving God, there is a reason why you're going through what you're going through now. There is. I mean, listen. This is a final one. Jesus on the cross. You know where I'm going with this. People who looked at Jesus on the cross would have said, there is nothing going on here but an innocent man getting crucified. And some would have said, there's nothing going on here but a guilty man getting what was due. Nobody looked at that and said, oh, look, God's redeeming the world. And because God's plans are too big for you and I, you don't know what he's doing in your Gethsemane. You don't know what he's doing in your pain. You don't know what he's doing in your desert. You don't know what he's doing in your grief. You don't know what he's doing in your despair. You don't know. It all seems meaningless to you and you want rid of it, but the Lord is working out something far greater, I think, than probably you will know in your life. So hang in there. Stay in there. Dig. You may only know the next step, but take the next step he's calling you to do. Keep digging. Keep going. The pain, the despair, the suffering, there's got to be a bigger picture for it. All things work to the good that of those who are called according to God's purpose. And if you're following him now, that love God and are called according to his purpose. But if you are part of God's family, if you have been redeemed, that's you. That's you. But again, you may never see it in this lifetime. You may never see it in this lifetime. See, I don't know why that happened. I don't know what that happened. What was that? I think it was a moth. Did it come out of my coat? Let's stand. Let's stand together.